Side 14. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 477. No, it wasn't supposed to. It's supposed to fly in a big curve. Motioning with his hand, the parabola trailed behind encompassing testing stands, assembly buildings, drawing them together as the crosses priests make in the air quarter and divide the staring congregations behind them.
Where does it go?
Wherever we tell it to.
May I fly in it some day? I'd fit inside, wouldn't I?
She asked impossible questions. Some day, Perkler told her, perhaps some day to the moon.
The moon?
As if he were going to tell her a story. When none followed, she made up them. The engineer in the next cubicle had a map of the moon tacked to his fiberboard wall, and she spent hours studying it, deciding where she wanted to live. Passing over the bright rays of Kepler, the rugged solitude of the southern highlands, the spectacular views at Copernicus and Eratosthenes, she took a small, pretty crater in the Sea of Tranquility called Maskelyne B. They would build a house right on the rim, Mutti and she and Perkler, gold mountains out one window and the wide sea out the other, and earth green and blue in the sky. Should he have told her what the seas of the moon really were? Told her there was nothing to breathe? His ignorance frightened him, his ineptitude as a father. Nights in the cubicle with Ilsa curled a few feet away in a canvas army cot, a little gray squirrel under her blanket, he'd wonder if she wasn't really better off as ward of the Reich. He'd heard there were camps, but saw nothing sinister in it. He took the government at their word. Re-education. I've made such a mess of everything. They have qualified people. They're trained to know. They know what a child needs. Staring up at the electric scatter from this part of Peenemünde, mapping across his piece of ceiling priorities, abandoned dreams, favor in the eyes of the master fantasy in Berlin, while sometimes Ilse whispered to him bedtime stories about the moon she would live on, till he had transferred silently to a world that wasn't this one after all. A map without national borders, insecure and exhilarating, in which flight was as natural as breathing. But I'll fall. No, rising, look down, nothing to be afraid of. This time it's good, yes. Firmly in flight, it's working. Yes. Perkler may be only witnessing tonight, or he may really be part of it. He hasn't been shown which it is. Look at this. There is about to be expedited for Friedrich August Kekule von Stradonitz, his dream of 1865, the great dream that revolutionized chemistry and made the IG possible. So that the right material may find its way to the right dreamer, everyone, everything involved must be exactly in place in the pattern. It was nice of Jung to give us the idea of an ancestral pool in which everybody shares the same dream material, but how it is we are each visited as individuals, each by exactly and only what he needs. Doesn't that imply a switching path of some kind? A bureaucracy? Why shouldn't the IG go to seances? They ought to be quite at home with the bureaucracies of the Kekule's dream here is being routed now past points which may arc through the silence in bright reluctance to live inside the moving moment, an imperfect, a human light over here interfering with the solemn binary decisions of these agents, who are now allowing the cosmic serpent in the violet splendor of its scales, shining that is definitely not human, to pass without feeling, without wonder, after you get a little time in whatever that means over here. One of these archetypes gets to look pretty much like any other. Oh, you hear some of these new hires, the seersucker crowd come in the first day. Wow, hey, that's the trio creation, huh? Ain't it? Jeepers, but enough. Pick up the reflexes for intent to gawk. You know, self-criticism's an amazing technique. It shouldn't work, but it does. Here's the rundown on Kekule's problem. Started out to become an architect. Turned out instead to be one of the Atlantes of chemistry. Most of the organic wing of that useful edifice bearing down on top of his head forever. Not just under the aspect of IG, but of world. Assuming that's a distinction you observe. Once again, it was the influence of Liebig, the great professor of chemistry on whose name street in Munich Perkler lived while he attended the TH. Liebig was at the University of Gießen when Kekule entered as a student. He inspired the young man to change his field. So Kekule brought the mind's eye of an architect over into chemistry. It was a critical switch. Liebig himself seems to have occupied the role of a gate, or sorting demon, such as his younger contemporary, Clark Maxwell, once proposed, helping to concentrate energy into one favored room of the creation at the expense of everything else. Later, witnesses have suggested that Clark Maxwell intended his demon not so much as convenience in discussing a thermodynamic idea as a parable about the actual existence of personnel like Liebig. We may gain an indication of how far the repression had grown by that time in the degree to which Clark Maxwell felt obliged to cold his warnings. Indeed, some theorists, usually the ones who find sinister meaning behind even Mrs. Clark Maxwell's notorious "It is time to go home, James, you are beginning to enjoy yourself," have made the extreme suggestion that the field equations themselves contain an ominous forewarning, cite as evidence the disturbing intimacy of the equations with the behavior of the double integrating circuit in the guidance system of the A4 rocket. The same double summing of current densities that led architect Etzel Oelsch to design for architect Albert Speer an underground factory at Nordhausen with just that symbolic shape. Young ex-architect Kekulé went looking among the molecules of the time for the hidden shapes he knew were there, shapes he did not like to think of as real physical structures but as rational formulas, showing the relationships that went on in metamorphoses, his quaint 19th century way of saying chemical reactions. But he could visualize, he saw, the four bonds of carbon lying in a tetrahedron, how carbon atoms could link up one to another into long chains. But he was stumped when he got to benzene. He knew there were six carbon atoms with a hydrogen attached to each one, but he could not see the shape. Not until the dream. Until he was made to see it, so that others might be seduced by its physical beauty and begin to think of it as a blueprint, a basis for new compounds, new arrangements, so that there would be a field of aromatic chemistry to ally itself with secular power and find new methods of synthesis, so there would be a German dye industry to become the IG. Kekulé dreams the great serpent, holding its own tail in its mouth, the dreaming serpent which surrounds the world. But the meanness, the cynicism with which this dream is to be used. The serpent that announces the world is a closed thing, cyclical, resonant, eternally returning, is to be delivered into a system whose only aim is to violate the cycle. Taking and not giving back, demanding that productivity and earnings keep on increasing with time, the system removing from the rest of the world these vast quantities of energy to keep its own tiny, desperate fraction showing a profit. And not only most of humanity, most of the world, animal, vegetable, and mineral, is laid waste in the process. The system may or may not understand that it's only buying time, and that time is an artificial resource to begin with of no value to anyone or system, which sooner or later must crash to its death when its addiction to energy has become more than the rest of the world can supply, dragging with it innocent souls all along the chain of life. Living inside them is like riding across the country in a bus driven by a maniac bent on suicide. Though he's amiable, keeps cracking jokes back. "Good morning, folks. This is Heidelberg here. We're coming into now. You know the old refrain, I lost heart in Heidelberg. Well, I have a friend who lost both his ears here. Don't get me wrong. It's really a nice town. The people are warm and wonderful when they're not bullying. Seriously, though, they treat you just fine. They don't just give you the key to the city. They give you the bungser und so weiter." On you roll across a countryside whose light is forever changing. Castles, heaps of rock, moons of different shapes and colors come and go. There are stops at odd hours of the mornings for reasons that are not announced. Out to stretch in lime-lit courtyards where the old men sit around the table under enormous eucalyptus trees you can smell in the night, shuffling the ancient decks oily and worn, throwing down swords and cups and trumps major in the tremor of light while behind them the bus is idling, waiting. "Passengers will now reclaim their seats. Much as you'd like to stay right here, learn the game, find your old age around this quiet table. It's no—" He is waiting beside the door of the bus in his pressed uniform. Lord of the night, he is checking your tickets, your ID and travel papers, and it's the wands of enterprise that dominate tonight. As he nods you by, you catch a glimpse of his face, his insane, committed eyes, and you remember for a terrible few heartbeats And of course it will end for you all in blood, in shock, without dignity. But there is meanwhile this trip to be on.
Over your own seat, where there ought to be an advertising plaque, is instead a quote from Rilke.
Once, only once. Of their favorite slogans. No return, no salvation, no cycle. That's not what they, nor their brilliant employee Kekulé, have taken the serpent to mean. No, what the serpent means is, how's this, that the 6 carbon atoms of benzene are in fact curled around into a closed ring, just like that snake with its tail in its mouth. Get it? The aromatic ring we know today. Peckler's Olaf Laszlo Jampf at this point in the spiel, removing from his fob a gold hexagon with the German Formé cross in the center.
A medal of honor from I.G. Farben, joking in his lovable old fart manner to think of the cross not as German so much as standing for the tetravalency of carbon. But who, lifting his open hands on each beat like a bandleader, who sent the dream?
It is never clear how rhetorical any of Jampf's questions are. Who sent this new serpentinous guard, and already too fouled, too crowded to qualify as any locus of innocence, unless innocence be our age's neutral, our silent passing into the machineries of indifference? Something that Kekulé's serpent had come to, not to destroy, but to define to us the loss of. We had been given certain molecules, certain combinations, and not others. We used what we found in nature, unquestioning, shamefully perhaps, but the serpent whispered, they can be changed. And new molecules assembled from the debris of the given. Can anyone tell me what else he whispered to us? Come, who knows? You, tell me, Berkler. His name fell on him like a thunderclap. And of course it wasn't Professor Dr. Jampf, after all, but a colleague from down the hall who had pulled reveille duty that morning. Ilse was brushing her hair and smiling at him. His daytime work had started to go better. Others were not so distant and more apt to look in his eyes. They'd met Ilse and been charmed. If he saw anything else in their faces, he ignored it.
Then, one evening, he returned from the Oya a little drunk, a little anxious, elated over a firing the next day, and found his cubicle empty.
Ilse, her flowered bag, the clothing she usually left strewn on the cot, had all vanished. Nothing left but a wretched sheet of log paper, which Berkler found so useful for taming the terror of exponential curves into the linear, the safe, the same kind she'd drawn pictures of her moon house on. Papi, they want me back. Maybe they'll let me see you again. I hope so. I love you, Ilse. Kurt Mondaugen found Berkler lying on her cot, breathing what he imagined were colors of her hair on the pillow. For a while then he went a little insane, talked of killing Weissmann, sabotaging the rocket program, and quitting his job and seeking asylum in England. Mondaugen sat and listened to all of it, touched Perkler once or twice, smoked his pipe, till at last, at 2 or 3 in the morning, Perkler had talked through a number of unreal options, cried, cursed, punched a hole into his neighbor's cubicle, through which he heard the man snoring unoblivious. Cooled by then to a vexed engineer elitism, they are fools. They don't even know what sine and cosine are, and they're trying to tell me. He agreed that, yes, he must wait, and let them do what they would do. If I set up a meeting with Weissmann, Mondaugen did suggest, could you be graceful, calm? No, not with him, not yet. When you think you are ready, let me know. When you're ready, you'll know how to handle it. Had he allowed himself a tone of command? He must have seen how much Perkler needed to be at someone's command. Nanny had learned to subdue her husband with her face, knew what cruel lines he expected of her mouth, what tones of voice he needed. When she left him, she left an unemployed servant who'd go with the first master that called, just a victim in a vacuum. Nur ein Opfer, sehr ins Vakuum. Won't somebody take advantage of me? Wird niemand ausnutzen mich auch? Just a slave with nobody to slave for. Nur ein Sklave ohne Herrin. Ja, ta, ta, ta. Hey, and who the heck wants that to be free? Wer zum Teufel die Freiheit braucht? All together now, all you masochists out there, especially those of you who don't have a partner tonight, alone with those fantasies that don't look like they'll ever come true, want you just to join in here with your brothers and sisters, let each other know you're alive and sincere, try to break through the silences, try to reach through and connect. Aw, the sodium lights aren't so bright in Berlin. I go to the bars, dear, but nobody's in. Oh, I'd much rather be in a Greek tragedy than be a victim in a vacuum tonight. Days passed, much like one another to Perkler. Identical Mon plunges into a routine dreary as winter now. He learned to keep an outward calm, at least. Learned to feel the gathering, the moving toward war that is unique to weapons programs. At first it simulates depression or non-specific anxiety. There may be esophageal spasms and unrecoverable dreams. You find you are writing notes to yourself. First thing in the morning, calm, reasoned assurances to the screaming mental case inside. 1. It is a combination. 1.1. It is a scalar quantity. 1.2. Its negative aspects are distributed isotropically. 2. It is not a conspiracy. It is not a vector. 2.11. It is not aimed at anybody. 2.12. It is not aimed at me. Und so weiter. The coffee became more and more metallic. Each deadline is now a crisis. Each is more intense than the last. Behind this job, like any other job, seems to lie something void, something terminal, something growing closer each day to manifestation. The new planet Pluto, she had whispered long ago, lying in the smelly dark, her long absent upper lip gibbous that night as the moon that ruled her. A sign now, held tight in its claws, it moves slowly, so slowly and so far away. But it will burst out. It is the grim phoenix which creates its own holocaust. Deliberate resurrection. Staged, under control, no grace, no interventions by God. Some are calling it a planet of national socialism. Brunhübner and that crowd all trying to suck out. They don't know they are telling the literal truth. Are you awake, Franz? Closer, the game of priorities and politicking grew more earnest. Army versus Luftwaffe, the weapons department versus the Ministry of Munitions, the SS, given their aspirations, versus everybody else, and even a simmering discontent that was to grow over the next few years in revolt against von Braun because of his youth and a number of test failures, though heaven knew there were always enough of those. They were the raw material of all testing station politics. In general, though, the test results grew more and more hopeful. It was impossible not to think of the rocket without thinking of Schicksal, of growing toward a shape predestined and perhaps a little otherworldly. The crews launched an uncontrolled series of A-5s, bringing some of them down by parachute, reaching a height of 5 miles and nearly to the speed of sound. Though the guidance people had still a long way to go, they had by this point switched over to vanes made of graphite, brought the yaw oscillations down to 5 degrees or so, and grown measurably happier about the rocket's stability. At some point in the winter, Perkler came to feel that he could handle a meeting with Weissman. He found the SS man on guard behind eyeglasses like Wagnerian shields, ready for unacceptable maxima, anger, accusation, a moment of office violence. It was like meeting a stranger. They had not spoken since the days at Kummersdorf, at the old Raketenflugplatz. In this quarter hour at Peenemünde, Perkler smiled more than he had in the year previous, spoke of his admiration for Perlmann's work in devising a cooling system for the propulsion. "What about the hot spots?" Weissman asked. It was a reasonable question, but also an intimacy. It came to Perkler that the man didn't give a damn about heating problems. This was a game, as Morgan had warned, ritualized as jiu-jitsu. "We've got heat flow densities," he usually did when he sang, "on the order of 3 million kilocalories per m-square h degree centigrade. Regenerative cooling is the best interim solution right now, but Perlmann has a new approach." Showing him with chalk and slate, trying for the profession. "He feels that if we use a film of alcohol on the inside of the chamber, we can reduce the heat transfer by a considerable amount." "You'll be injecting it." "Correct. How much fuel is that going to reroute? How's it going to affect the engine efficiency?" Perkler had the figures. "Right now, injection is a plumber's nightmare, but with the delivery schedules as they are, what about the two-stage combustion process?" "Gives us more volume, better turbulence, but there's also a non-isotropic pressure drop which cuts into... We're trying any number of approaches. If we could depend on better funding..." "Ah, not my department. We could do with a more generous budget ourselves." They both laughed then. Gentlemen scientists, under a stingy bureaucracy, suffering together. Perkler understood that he had been negotiating for his child and for Laney. That the questions and answers were not exactly code for something else, but in the way of an evaluation of Perkler personally. He was expected to behave a certain way, not just to play a role, but to live it. Any deviations into jealousy, metaphysics, vagueness would be picked up immediately. He would either be directed back on course or allowed to fall. Through winter and spring, the sessions with Weissmann became routine. Perkler grew into his new disguise, prematurely aged adolescent whiz, often finding that it could indeed take him over, him longer at reference books and firing data, speaking lines for him he could never have planned in advance, gentle, scholarly, racket-obsessed language that surprised him. Late August, he had his second visit. It should have been Ilse returned, but Perkler wasn't sure. As before, she showed up alone, unannounced, ran to him, kissed him, called him Papi, but her hair, for one thing, was definitely dark brown and cut differently. Her eyes were longer, set differently, her complexion less fair. It seemed she'd grown taller, but at that age shoot up overnight, don't they? If it was that age. Even as Perkler embraced her, the perverse whispering began, "Is it the same one? Have they sent you a different child? Why didn't you look closer last time, Perkler?" This time he asked how long they were going to let her stay.
"They'll tell me, and I'll try to let you know."
And would there be time for him to recalibrate from his little squirrel who dreamed of living on the moon to this dark, long-legged southern creature whose awkwardness and need of a father were so touching, so clear even to Perkler at this their second, or was it first, or third, meet? Hardly any news of Lainey. They had been separated, Ilse said, during the winter. She'd heard a rumor mother had been moved to a different... So. Present a pawn, withdraw the queen. Weissmann waiting to see how Perkler would react. This time he had gone too far. Perkler laced up his shoes and calmly enough went out looking for the SS man, cornered him in his office, denounced him before a panel of three dim governmental figures, the speech eloquently climaxing as he threw chessboard and pieces Weissmann's arrogantly bling face. Perkler's impetuous, yes, a rebel. But, Generaldirektor, it's his kind of fire, and honestly, we need... The child had suddenly come into his arms to kiss him again. Free. Perkler forgot his troubles and held her to his heart for a long time without speaking. But that night, a cubicle, only breathing, no moon wishes this year, from her cot, he was awake, wondering, one daughter, one impostor, daughter twice, two impostors, beginning to work out the combinations for a third visit, a fourth. Weissmann, those behind him, had thousands of these children. As the years passed, as they grew more nubile, would Perkler even come to fall in love with one? Would she reach the king's row that way and become a queen's substitute for lost, for forgotten Lainey? The opponent knew that Perkler's suspicion would always be stronger than any fears about real incest. They could make up new rules, complicate the game indefinitely. How could any man as empty as Perkler felt that night be flexible enough for that? Cut. It was ridiculous. Hadn't he seen her go by from every angle in their old city rooms? Carried, asleep, crying, crawling, laughing, hungry. Often he had come home too tired to make it to the bed and had lain on the floor with his head under the one wood table, curled, beaten, wondering if he could even sleep. The first time Ilse noticed, she crawled over and sat staring at him for some time. She had seen him still, horizontal, with his eyes shut. He drifted toward sleep. Ilse leaned over and bit him the leg, as she bit crusts of bread, cigarettes, shoes, anything that might be food. "I'm your father. You're inert and edible." Perkler screamed and rolled out of the way. Ilse began to cry. He was too tired to want to think about discipline. It was Lainey, finally, who calmed her down. He knew all Ilse's cryings. Her first attempt at words, the colors of her, the sounds and shapes that brought her tranquility. He ought to know if this child was his own or not, but he didn't. Too much happened between. Too much history and dream. Next morning, his group leader handed Perkler a footchit and a paycheck with a vacation bonus. No travel restrictions, but a time limit of 2 weeks. Translation, will you come back? He packed some things, and they got on the train for Staten. The sheds and assembly building gantries that were the map of her shadowing into great purple, isolated across the marsh backs away. Not to come back? He'd left their destination up to her. She chose Zwölfkinder. It was the end of summer, nearly the end of peacetime. The children knew what was coming.
Playing refugee, they crowded the railway carriages, quieter, more solemn than Perkler had expected, feeling an urge to start babbling each time Ilse's eyes turned from the window toward his own. He saw the same thing in all their eyes. He was strange to them, to her, and growing stranger, and he knew of no way to reverse it.
In a corporate state, a place must be made for innocence and its many uses. In developing an official version of innocence, the culture of childhood has proven invaluable. Games, fairy tales, legends from history, all the paraphernalia of make-believe can be adapted and even embodied in a physical place, such as at Zwölfkinder. Over the children's resort, almost a spa. If you were in a couldn't get inside the city limits without a child escort, there was a child mayor, a child city council of 12, children picked up the papers, fruit peelings, and bottles you left in the street. Children gave you guided tours through the Tierpark, the Horde of the Nibelungen, cautioning you to silence during the impressive reenactment of Bismarck's elevation at the spring equinox of 1871 to Prince and Imperial Chancellor. Child police reprimanded you if you were caught alone, without your child accompanying. Whoever carried on the real business of the town, it could not have been children, they were well hidden. A late summer, a late retrospective blooming. Birds flew everywhere, the sea warmed, the sun shone on into the evenings. Random children took your shirt cuff by mistake and trudged along for minutes before discovering you were not their adult and then wandered off with backward smiles. The glass mountain twinkled rose and white in the hot sun. The elf king and his queen made a royal progress every noon with a splendid retinue of dwarves and sprites, handing out cakes, ices, and candies. At each intersection or square, bands played, marches, folk dances, hot jazz, Hugo Wolf. Children went streaming like confetti at the drinking fountains where soda water sparkled deep inside the fanged mouths of dragons, of wild lions and tigers. The queues of children waited, each for his moment of danger, leaning halfway into the shadow, into the smell of wet cement and old water, into the mouth of the beast to drink. In the sky, the tall Ferris wheel spun. From Peenemünde they had come 280 kilometers, which was to be, coincidentally, the operational range of the A4. Among all there was to choose from, wheel, myths, jungle animals, clowns, Ilse found her way to the Antarctic panorama. Two or three boys, hardly older than she, wandered through the imitation wilderness, bundled up in seal skins, constructing cairns and planting flags in the August humidity. Watching them made Perkler sweat. A few sled dogs lay suffering in the shade of the dirty papier-mâché sastrugi, on plaster snow that had begun to crack. A hidden projector threw images of the aurora on a white scrim. Half a dozen stuffed penguins also dotted the landscape.
So you want to live at the South Pole? Have you given up so easily on...
God! Idiot, that was a slip.
On the moon?
He'd been good up till then about cross-examining. He couldn't afford to know who she was. In the false Antarctic, in ignorance of what had attracted her there, uneasy and dripping sweat, he waited for her answer. She or they let him off. Oh, with a shrug, who wants to live on the moon? They never brought it up again. Back at their hotel, they were handed the key by an 8-year-old desk clerk, rose in a whining elevator run by a uniformed child to a room still warm from the day's heat. She closed the door, took off her hat, and scaled it over to her bed. Perkler collapsed on his own bed. He came over to take off his shoes.
Papi, gravely unlacing, may I sleep next to you tonight?
One of her hands had come lightly to rest on the beginning of his bare calf. Their eyes met for half a second. A number of uncertainties shifted then for Perkler and locked into sense. To his shame, his first feeling was pride. He hadn't known he was so vital to the program. Even in this initial moment, he was seeing it from their side. Every quirk goes in the dossier, gambler, foot fetishist, or soccer fan. It's all important. It can all be used. Right now, we have to keep them happy, or at least neutralize the foci of their unhappiness. You may not understand what their work really is, not at the level of the data, but you're an administrator, after all, a leader. Your job is to get results. Perkler now has mentioned a daughter, yes.
Yes, we know it's disgusting. One never can tell what they have locked up in there with those equations, but we must all put off our judgments for now. There'll be time after the war to get back to the Perklers and their dirty little secrets. He hit her upside the head with his open hand, a loud and terrible blow. That took care of his anger. Then before she could cry or speak, he had dragged her up on the bed next to him, her dazed little hands already at the buttons of his trousers, her white frock already pulled above her waist. She had been wearing nothing at all underneath, nothing all day. "How I've wanted you," she whispered as paternal plow found its way into filial furrow. And after hours of amazing incest, they dressed in silence and crept out into the leading edge of faintest flesh dawn, everything they would need packed inside her flowered bag, past sleeping children doomed to the end of summer, past monitors and railway guards, down at last to the water and the fishing boats, to a fatherly old sea dog in a braided captain's hat, who welcomed them aboard and stashed them below decks, where she snuggled down in the bunk as they got underway and sucked him for hours, while the engine pounded, till the captain called, "Come on up and take a look at your new home." Gray and green, through the mist, it was Denmark. "Yes, there are free people here. Good luck to both of you." The three of them, there on deck, stood hugging. No. What Perkler did was choose to believe she wanted comfort that night, wanted not to be alone. Despite their game, their palpable evil, though he had no more reason to trust Ilse than he trusted them by an act not of faith, not of courage, but of conservation. He chose to believe that. Even in peacetime, with unlimited resources, he couldn't have proven her identity. Not beyond the knife edge of zero tolerance his precision eye needed. The years Ilse would have spent between Berlin and Peenemünde were so hopelessly tangled for all of Germany that no real chain of events could have been established for sure, not even Perkler's hunch that somewhere in the state's oversized paper brain a specific perversity had been assigned him and dutifully stored. For every government agency, the Nazi Party set up a duplicate. Committees fissioned, merged, generated spontaneously, disappeared. No one would show a man his dossier. It was not, in fact, even clear to him that he had made a choice, but it was in those humming moments in the room smelling of a summer day, whose light no one had lit yet, with her round straw hat a frail moon on the bedspread, lights of the wheel slowly pouring red and green over and over outside in the dark, and a group of schoolboys singing in the street a refrain from before their time, their sold-out and cruelly handled time. "Juch hairasasa, o tempo tempora." That board in pieces and patterns at least all did come clear for him, and Perkler knew that while he played, this would have to be Ilse, truly his child, truly as he could make her. It was the real moment of conception in which, years too late, he became her father. Through the rest of the furlough they strolled about Zwölfkinder, always hand in hand, lanterns swaying from the trunks of elephants' heads on top of tall pillars lit their way, over spidery bridges looking down at snow leopards, apes, hyenas, along the miniature railway between the corrugated pipe legs of steel mesh dinosaurs down to the patch of African desert, where every 2 hours exactly the treacherous natives attacked an encampment of General von Trotha's brave men in blue, all the parts played by exuberant boys, and a great patriotic favorite with children of all ages. Up on the giant wheel, so naked, so void of grace, there for only the clear mission to lift and to frighten. On their last night, though he didn't know it, for they would take her as abruptly and invisibly as before, they stood looking in again at stuffed penguins and false snow, and around them the artificial aurora flickered. "Next year," squeezing her hand, "we'll come back here if you like."
"Oh, yes, every year, puppy."
Next day she was gone, taken back into the coming war, leaving Perkler alone in a country of children, to go back to Peenemünde, after all, alone. So it has gone for the 6 years since, the daughter a year, each one about a year older each time, taking up nearly from scratch. The only continuity has been her name, and Zwölfkinder, and Perkler's love. Love something like the persistence of vision, for they have used it to create for him the moving image of a daughter. flashing him only these summertime frames of her, leaving it to him to build the illusion of a single child. What would the time scale matter, a 24th of a second or a year? No more, the engineer thought, than in a wind tunnel or an oscillograph whose turning drum you could speed or slow at will. Outside the Peneminde wind tunnel, Pekler has come to stand at night, next to the great sphere, 40 feet high, listening to the laboring pumps as they evacuate the air from the white sphere, 5 minutes of growing void, then one terrific gasp, 20 seconds of supersonic flow, then the fall of the shutter and the pumps starting up again. He has listened and taken it to imply his own cycle of shuttered love. Growing empty over the year for 2 weeks in August, engineered with the same care. He has smiled and drunk toasts and traded barracks humor with Major Weissman, while all the time, behind the music and the giggling, he could hear the flesh of pieces moved in darkness and winter across the marshes and mountain chains of the board. Watched run after run the Halbmodell results out of the wind tunnel, showing how the net normal force would be distributed over the rocket's length for hundreds of different Mach numbers, seen the true profile of the rocket warped and travestied, a rocket of wax, humped like a dolphin at around caliber 2, necking down toward the tail, which was then stretched up impossibly in a high point with a lower shoulder aft of it, and seen how his own face might be plotted, not in light, but in net forces acting upon it from the flow of Reich and coercion and love it moved through, and known that it must suffer the same degradation as death will warp face to skull. In 43, because he was away at Zwölfkinder, Pekler missed the British air raid on Peenemünde. Returning to the station as soon as he came in sight of the foreign workers' quarters at Trassenheide erased and smashed, bodies still being dug from the wreckage, a terrible suspicion began and would not be put down. Weissman was saving him for something, some unique destiny. Somehow the man had known the British would bomb that night, known even in 39, and so arranged the tradition of an August furlough year after year, but all toward protecting Pekler from the one bad night. Not quite balanced. A bit paranoid, yes, but the thought purred on in his brain, and he felt himself turning to stone. Smoke seeped from the earth. Charred trees fell as he watched at no more than a breath from the direction of the sea. Powdered dust rose up at every footfall, turning clothes white, faces to masks of dust. The farther up the peninsula, the less damage. A strange gradient of death and wreckage, south to north, in which the poorest and most helpless got it worst, as indeed the gradient was to run east to west in London a year later when the rockets began to fall. Most of the casualties had been among foreign workers, a euphemism for civilian prisoners brought in from countries under German occupation. The wind tunnel and the measuring house were untouched. The pre-production works only slightly damaged. Pekler's colleagues were outside scientist housing, which had been hit, phantoms moving in morning fog, still not burned off, washing up in buckets of beer because the water was still out. They stared at Pekler, failing, enough of them, to keep accusation out of their faces. I wish I could have missed this. Dr. Thiel is dead. How was Fairyland, Pekler? I'm sorry, he said. It wasn't his fault. The others were silent, some watching, some still in shock from the night. Montauken showed up then. We're exhausted. Could you come with me to pre-production? A lot has to be sorted out. We need a hand. They shuffled along, each in his own dust cloud. It was terrible, Montauken said. All of us have been under some strain. They sounded like I'd done it. You feeling guilty because you weren't here? I'm wondering why I wasn't here, that's all. Because you were in Zwölfkinder, replied the enlightened one. Don't invent complications. He tried not to. That was Weissman's job, wasn't it? Weissman was the sadist. He had responsibility for coming up with new game variations, building toward a maximum cruelty in which Pekler would be unlaid to nerves, vessels, and tendons, every last convolution of brain flattened out in the radiance of the black candles. Nowhere to shelter, entirely his master's possession, the moment in which he is defined to himself at last. This is what Pekler could feel, waiting now, a room he'd never seen, a ceremony he couldn't memorize in advance. There were false alarms.
Perkler was almost sure once during the winter during the test series at Vizna. They had moved east into Poland to fire over land. The shots from Warnemünde were all out to sea, and there had been no way to observe the re-entry of the A-4. Vizna was almost exclusively an SS project, part of Major General Kammler's empire building. The rocket at that point was plagued by an airburst problem in its terminal phase. The vehicle blew apart before reaching the target. Everyone had an idea. It might be an overpressure in the liquid oxygen tank. Perhaps because the rocket coming down was lighter by 10 tons of fuel and oxidizer, the shift in the center of gravity was making it unstable. Or perhaps the insulation on the alcohol tank was at fault, somehow allowing residual fuel to be burned on re-entry. This was Perkler's reason for being there. By then he was no longer in the propulsion group or even working as a designer. He was in the materials office, expediting the procurement of various plastics for insulation, shock absorption, gasketry, exciting stuff. The orders to Vizna were strange enough to be Weissmann's work. The day Perkler went out to sit in the Polish meadows at the exact spot where the rocket was supposed to come down, he was certain. Green rye and low hills for miles all around. Perkler was by a small trench in the Saranaki target area, pointing his binoculars south toward Vizna like everybody else. Waiting. Erwartung in the crosshairs, with the just-sprung rye blowing, its gentler nap being brushed up by the wind. Look down at this countryside, down through rocket miles of morning space, the many shades of forest green, Polish farmhouses white and brown, dark eels of rivers catching the sun at their curves, and at the very center down there in the Holy X, Perkler, crucified, invisible at first look, but in a moment, now beginning to resolve as the fall gathers momentum. But how can he believe in its reality up there? Insects whine. The sun is almost warm. He can gaze off at the red earth and millions of glowing stalks and fall nearly into a light trance. In shirt sleeves, with his bony knees pointing up, the gray suit jacket wrinkled years beyond last pressing, bundled under his ass to soak up the dew, the others he came out with are dotted here about ground zero, blithe Nazi buttercups. Binoculars sway from slate-colored horsehide straps around their necks. The Ascania crew fuss with their equipment, and one of the SS liaison men, Weissmann isn't here, keeps looking at his watch, then at the sky, then the watch, the crystal becoming, in brief flashes, on, off, a nacreous circle binding together the hour and the fleecy sky. Perkler scratches at a graying 48-hour beard, bites at lips very chapped, as if he has spent most of the late winter outside. He has a winter look. Around his eyes, over the years, has grown a ruinous system of burst capillaries, shadows, folds, crow's feet, a ground that by now has gathered in the simple, direct eyes of his younger and poorer days. No, something was in them even then, something others saw and knew they could use and found how to. Something Perkler missed. He spent enough of his life looking into mirrors. He really ought to remember. The airburst, if it happens, will be in visual range. Abstractions, math, models are fine, but when you're down to it and everybody's hollering for a fix, this is what you do. You go and sit exactly on the target with indifferent shallow trenches for shelter, and you watch it in the silent fire bloom of its last few seconds and see what you will see. Chances are astronomically against a perfect hit. Of course, that is why one is safest at the center of the target area. Rockets are supposed to be like artillery shells. They disperse about the aiming point in a giant ellipse, the ellipse of uncertainty. But Perkler, though trusting as much as any scientist in uncertainty, is not feeling too secure here. It is, after all, his own personal ass whose quivering sphincter is centered right on ground zero. And there is more to this than ballistics. There is Weissmann. Any number of chemists and materials people know as much about insulation as Perkler, why should he have been picked? Unless somewhere in his brain now two foci sweep together and become one. Zero ellipse, a single point, a live warhead secretly loaded, special bunkers for everyone else. Yes, that's what he wants. All tolerances in the guidance cooperating toward a perfect shot right on top of Perkler. Ah, Weissmann, your end game lacks finesse. But there were never spectators and judges, not in all this time, and whoever said the end could not be this brutal. paranoia has rushed Perkler, drowned him to the temples and scalp. He may have shit, he can't tell. His pulse thuds in his neck, his hands and feet ache. The black-suited blonde enforcers look on, their metal insignia twinkle. Low hillsides lie under early sun. All the field glasses stare south. The aggregat is en route. Nothing can be changed. No one else here cares for the penetralia of the moment or last mysteries. There have been too many rational years. The paper has piled too thick and far. Perkler cannot reconcile, not really his dream of the perfectly victimized with the need bred into him to take care of business, nor see how these may be one and the same. The A4 must, after all, go out in the field very soon. This failure rate must be brought down, and so those who've come are here. And if there is a massive failure of vision this morning in the Polish meadow, if no one, not even the most paranoid, can see anything at all beyond the stated requirements, certainly it's not unique to this time, this place, where the eyes cupped against the black binoculars are looking only for the day's reluctant virgin, as the witty rocketeers have dubbed their problem rockets, to announce herself, to note where, forward to aft, the trouble may be, the shape of a vapor trail, the sound of the burst, anything that might help. At Tharnaki, as the records tell it, the rocket came down that day with the usual double blast, a streak of white condensation in the blue sky, another premature airburst. Steel fragments fell 100 feet away from the zero point, flashing into the rye like hail. Perkler saw the explosion no more than anyone else. He was never sent out again. The SS people watched him get to his feet and stretch and slowly move off with the others. Weissmann would get his report. New varieties of torture would be coming. But inside Perkler's life, on no record but his soul, his poor, harassed German soul, the time base has lengthened and slowed. The perfect rocket is still up there, still descending. He still waits, even now, alone at Zwölfkinder, waiting for Ilse, for this summer's return, and with it, an explosion that will take him by surprise. In the spring, when the winds at Peenemünde had shifted around to the southwest, and the first birds were back, Perkler was transferred to the underground factory at Nordhausen in the Harz. Work at Peenemünde after the British raid had begun to fall off. The plan, again Tammler's, was now to disperse testing and production around Germany to prevent another and possibly fatal Allied attack. Perkler's duties at the Mittelwerke were routine, materials, procurement. He slept in a bunk next to a wall of dynamited stone painted white with a bulb over his head burning all night long. He dreamed that the bulb was a representative of Weissmann, a creature whose bright filament was its soul. They held long dream dialogues whose substance Perkler could never remember. The bulb was explaining the plot to him in detail. It was more grand and sweeping than Perkler could ever have imagined. It seemed many nights to be purely music. His consciousness moving through the soundscape at bay, observing, compliant, still precariously safe, but not for long. At the time, there were rumors of an estrangement growing between Weissmann and his monster, Ensign. The Schwarzkommando by then had grown away from the SS structure, much as the SS itself had from the German army. Their power now lay not in absolute weaponry, but in information and expertise. Perkler was happy to hear that Weissmann was having his troubles, but at a loss how to use it to any advantage. When his orders to Nordhausen had come through, he'd had a flash of despair. Was the game adjourned then? He might never see Ilse again, but a memo had come telling him to report to Weissmann in his office. The hair at Weissmann's temples was graying and disarranged. Perkler saw that one earpiece of his glasses was held on with a paperclip. His desk was a litter of documents, reports, reference books. It was a surprise to see him looking less diabolical than harassed as any civil servant under pressure. His eyes were aimed in Perkler's direction, but the lenses distorted them. "You understand that this transfer to Nordhausen is voluntary?" Perkler understood with relief and 2 seconds of actual love for his protector that the game was still on. "It will be something new." "Yes?" Partly a challenge, but partly interested, too. "Production, we've been so involved here with the research and development end. It's not a weapon for us so much as a flying laboratory, as Dr. Thiel said once." "You miss Dr. Thiel?"
Yes, he wasn't in my section. I didn't know him well. A shame he got caught in the raid. We all move in an ellipse of uncertainty, don't we?
Heckler allowed himself a look at the cluttered desk, quick enough to be taken either for nervousness or as a comeback. Weissman, looks like you have your own ellipse, all right. Oh, I don't have the time usually to worry. At least the Mittelwerke is underground.
The tactical sites won't be.
You think I might be sent? Weissman shrugged and favored Perkler with a big fake smile.
My dear Perkler, how can anyone predict where you'll go?
We'll see how it all develops. Later, in his own, with his guilt become a sensual thing, prickling at his eyes and membranes like an allergy, it would seem to Perkler that he could not, even by that day in Weissman's office, have been ignorant of the truth. That he had known the truth with his senses, but allowed all the evidence to be misfiled where it wouldn't upset him. Known everything, but refrained from the only act that could have redeemed him. He should have throttled Weissman where he sat, corrugations of skinny throat and Adam's apple sliding under Perkler's palms, thick eyeglasses sliding off as the weak little eyes go bleering helplessly after their final darkener. Perkler helped with his own blindness. He knew about Nordhausen and the Dora camp. He could see the starved bodies, the eyes of the foreign prisoners being marched to work at 4 in the morning in the freezing cold and darkness, the shuffling thousands in their striped uniforms. He had known, too, all along that Ilse was living in a re-education camp, but it wasn't till August, when the furlough arrived as usual in its blank craft envelope, and Perkler rode northward through the gray kilometers of a Germany he no longer recognized, bombed and burned, the wartime villages and rainy purple heath, and found her, at last, waiting in the hotel lobby at Zwölfkinder, with the same darkness in her eyes. How had he missed it till now, such swimming orbits of pain, that he could finally put the two data together? For months, while her father across the wire or walls did his dutiful hackwork, she had been prisoner only a few meters away from him, beaten, perhaps violated. If he must curse Weissman, then he must also curse himself. Weissman's cruelty was no less resourceful than Perkler's own engineering skill, the gift of Daedalus that allowed him to put as much labyrinth as required between himself and the inconveniences of caring. They had sold him convenience, so much of it, all on credit, and now they were collecting. Trying, a bit late for it, to open himself to the pain he should have been feeling, he questioned her now. Did she know the name of her camp? Yes, Ilse confirmed, or was told to answer, that it was Dora. The night before she left to come here, she'd seen a hanging. Evening was the hour for the hangings. Did he want to hear about it? Did he want to hear about it? He was very hungry. They spent the first few days eating whatever Zwölfkinder had to sell. There was less than the year before, and it was much more expensive, but the Enclave of Innocence still enjoyed a high priority, so there was something. Not so many children this year, though. The engineer and girl had the place practically to themselves. The wheel and most of the other rides stood motionless. Petrol shortage, a child guard informed them. Luftwaffe flights roared overhead. Nearly every night the sirens cried out and they watched the searchlights come on in Wismar and in Lübeck and sometimes heard the bombs. What was Perkler doing in this dream world, this lie? His country waited to be crushed between invaders from east and west. Back at Nordhausen, the hysteria had risen to epic scale as the first rockets were about to go out into the field, about to fulfill engineering prophecies old as peacetime. Why, at this critical moment, had they let Perkler off? Who else these days was getting furloughs, and what was Ilse doing here? Wasn't she supposed to be too old by now for fairy tales? Her new breasts so visible now beneath her frock, her eyes so nearly empty, drifting without real interest toward random boys destined for the Folkstuhl. Older boys no more interested in her. They dreamed of their orders of colossal explosions and death. If they even saw her, it was sidewise, sly. Her father will tame her. Her teeth will bite the pole. Someday I will have a herd of them for myself, but first I must find my captain somewhere out in the war. First they must deliver me from this little place. Who was that going by just then? Who was the slender boy who flickered across her path, so blonde, so white he was nearly invisible, in the hot haze that had come to settle over Zwölfkinder? Did she see him, and did she know him for her own second shadow? She was conceived because her father saw a movie called Alpdrücken one night and got a hard-on. Perkler, in his horny staring, had missed the director's clever Gnostic symbolism in the lighting scheme of the two shadows, Cain's and Abel's. But Ilse, some Ilse, has persisted beyond her cinema mother, beyond film's end, and so have the shadows of shadows. In the zone, all will be moving under the old dispensation, inside the Cainist's light and space. Not out of any precious girlerei, but because the double light was always there, outside all film. And that shucking and jiving movie maker was the only one around at the time who happened to notice it and use it, although in deep ignorance, then and now, of what he was showing the nation of starers. So that summer, Ilse passed herself by, too fixed at some shadowless interior noon to mark the intersection, or to care. She and Perkler hardly talked this time. It was their mutest holiday together. She walked broodful, her head down, her hair hooding her face, brown legs kicking at refuse the undermanned garbage detail hadn't picked up. Was it her time of life, or did she resent being under orders to spend time with a dull and aging engineer at a place she'd outgrown years ago? You don't really want to be here, do you? They sat by a polluted stream, throwing bread to ducks. Perkler's stomach was upset from ersatz coffee and tainted meat. His head ached. It's here or the camp. Her face stubbornly aside. I don't really want to be anywhere. I don't care. Ilse, do you like it here? Do you want to be back under your mountain? Do you talk to the elves, Franz? No, I don't enjoy it where I am. Franz? But I have my job. Yes, so do I. My job is being a prisoner. I'm a professional inmate. I know how to get favors, who to steal from, how to inform, how to... Any minute she'd say it. Please, stop it, Ilse. This time Perkler got hysterical and did slap her. Duck, surprised at the sharp report, about-faced and waddled away. Ilse gazed back at him. No tears. Eyes, room after room, strung into the shadows of an old pre-war house he could wander for years, hearing voices and finding doors, hunting himself, his life as it might have been. He could not bear indifference from her. Close to losing control, Perkler committed then his act of courage. He quit the game. If you don't want to come back next year, even though next year meant so little by that point in Germany, you don't have to. It would be better if you didn't. She knew immediately what he'd done. She pulled one knee up and rested her forehead there and thought, I'll come back, she said very quietly. You?
Yes. Really.
He did, then, let everything go, every control. He veered into the wind of his long isolation, shuddering terribly. He cried. She took his hands. The floating ducks watched. The sea cooled under the hazy sun. An accordion played somewhere back in the town. From behind the decaying mythical statues, sentenced children shouted to each other. Summer ended. Back at the Mittelwerke, he tried and kept trying to get into the Dora camp and find Ilse. It didn't matter any more about Weissmann. The SS guards each time were courteous, understanding, impossible to get past. The workload now was incredible. Perkler was getting less than 2 hours sleep a day. News of the war reached under the mountain only as rumors and shortages. Procurement philosophy had been triangular, three possible sources for the same part, in case one was destroyed. Depending what didn't come from where or how late it was, you knew which factories had been bombed, which rail connections taken out. Toward the end, you had to try and fabricate many of the components locally. When Perkler had time to think, he was met by the growing enigma of Weissmann's silence. To provoke him, or the memory of him, Perkler went out of his way to talk to officers in Major Fürschner's security detail, looking for news. None of them responded to Perkler as anything more than a nuisance. They'd heard rumors that Weissmann was no longer here, but in Holland, in command of his own rocket battery. Enzian had dropped out of sight, along with many key Schwarzkommando. Perkler grew more and more certain that this time the game was really over, that the war had caught them all, given new life-death priorities, and no more leisure for torturing a minor engineer. He was able to relax some, move through the day's routine, wait for the end, even allow himself to hope that the thousands in Dora would soon be free, among them Ilse, some acceptable Ilse. But in the spring he did see Weissmann again. He woke from a dream of a gentle Zwölfkinder that was also Nordhausen, a city of elves producing toy moon rockets, and there was Weissmann's face at the edge of his bunk, watching him. He seemed to have aged 10 years, and Perkler hardly recognized him. "There isn't much time," Weissmann whispered. "Come with me." They moved through the white, sleepless bustle of the tunnels, Weissmann walking slowly and stiffly, both men silent. In one of the office spaces, half a dozen others were waiting, along with some SS and SD. "We've already obtained permission from your groups," Weissmann said, "to release you for work on a special project. This will be the highest possible security. You'll be billeted separately, eat separately, and speak to no one who is not present in this room." They all looked around to see who that might be. No one they knew. They looked back at Weissmann. He wanted a modification worked into one rocket. Only one. Its serial number had been removed and 5 zeros painted in. Perkler knew immediately that this was what Weissmann had been saving him for. This was to be his special destiny. It made no sense to him. He had to develop a plastic fairing of a certain size with certain insulating properties for the propulsion section of the rocket. The propulsion engineer was the busiest on the project, rerouting steam and fuel lines, relocating hardware. Whatever the new device was, nobody saw it. According to the rumor, it was being produced elsewhere and was nicknamed the Schwarzgerät because of the high secrecy surrounding it. Even the weight was classified. They were through inside of 2 weeks, and the Vorrichtung für die Isolierung was on its way to the field. Perkler reported back to his regular supervisor, and the routine went on as before. He never saw Weissmann again. The first week in April, with American units supposed to be arriving at any moment, most of the engineers were packing, collecting addresses of co-workers, drinking farewell toasts, drifting through the emptying bays. There was a graduation feeling in the air. It was hard not to whistle Gaudiamus Igitur. Suddenly the cloistered life was about to come to an end. A young SS guard, one of the last to leave, found Perkler in the dusty cafeteria, handed him an envelope, and left without a word. It was the usual furlough form, superseded now by the imminent death of the government and a travel permit to Zwölfkinder. Where the dates should have been, someone had written almost illegibly, "After hostilities end." On the back, in the same hand, Weissmann's, a note to Perkler. "She has been released. She will meet you there."
He understood that this was payment for the retrofit work he'd done on the 00000. How long had Weissmann been keeping him deliberately on ice, all so he'd have a plastics man he could depend on when the time came?
On the last day, Perkler walked out the south end of the main tunnels. Lorries were everywhere, all engines idling. Farewell in the spring air, tall trees, sunlit green on the mountainsides. The Obersturmbannführer was not at his post when Perkler went into Dora. He was not looking for Ilse, or not exactly. He may have felt that he ought to look, finally. He was not prepared. He did not know. Had the data, yes, but did not know with senses or heart. The odors of shit, death, sweat, sickness, mildew, piss. The breathing of Dora wrapped him as he crept in, staring at the naked corpses being carried out now that America was so close, to be stacked in front of the crematoriums, the men's penises hanging, their toes clustering white and round as furls. Each face so perfect, so individual. The lips stretched back into death grins, a whole silent audience caught at the punchline of the joke. And the living, stacked 10 to a straw mattress, the weakly crying, coughing losers. All his vacuums, his labyrinths, had been the other side of this. While he lived and drew marks on paper, this invisible kingdom had kept on in the darkness outside all this time. Perkler vomited. He'd cried some. The walls did not dissolve, no prison wall ever did, not from tears, not at this finding on every pallet and every cell that the faces are ones he knows, after all, and holds dear as himself, and cannot then let them return to that silence. But what can he ever do about it? How can he ever keep them? impotence, mirror rotation of sorrow, works him terribly as runaway heart beating, and with hardly any chances left him for good rage or for turning. Where it was darkest and smelled the worst, Heckler found a woman lying, a random woman. He sat for half an hour holding her bone hand. She was breathing. Before he left, he took off his gold wedding ring and put it on the woman's thin finger, curling her hand to keep it from sliding off. If she lived, the ring would be good for a few meals or a blanket or a night indoors or a ride home. Back to Berlin, with a terrific thunderstorm blowing over the city, Margarita has brought Slothrop to a rickety wood house near the Spree in the Russian sector. A burned-out Königsteiger tank guards the entrance, its paint scorched, threads mangled and blasted off of the drive sprocket, its dead Monster 88 angled down to point at the gray river, hissing and spiculed with the rain. Inside are bats nesting in the rafters, remains of beds with a moldy smell, broken glass and bat shit on the bare wood floor. Windows boarded up except where the stove is vented through because the chimney's down. On a rocking chair lies a moleskin coat, a taupe cloud. Paint from some long-ago artist is still visible over the floor in wrinkled splashes of aged magenta, saffron, steel blue, reverse deformations of paintings whose whereabouts are unknown. Back in a corner hangs a tarnished mirror, birds and flowers painted in white all around its frame, reflecting Margarita and Slothrop and the rain out the open door. Part of the ceiling, blown away when the King Tiger died, is covered now with soggy and stained cardboard posters, all of the same cloaked figure in the broad-brimmed hat with its legend, Der Feind hört zu. Water drips through in half a dozen places. Greta lights the kerosene lamp. It warms the rain light with a handful of yellow. Slothrop builds a fire in the stove while Margarita ducks down under the house where it turns out there's a great stash of potatoes. Jeepers! Slothrop hasn't seen a potato for months. There's onions in a sack, too, and even wine. She cooks, and they both sit there just pigging on those spuds. Later, without paraphernalia or talk, they fuck each other to sleep. But a few hours later, Slothrop wakes up and lies there wondering where he's going. Well, to find that Zoyre Boomer, soon as this rain lets up, give the man his hashish. But what then? Slothrop and the Esgeret and the Yamf Imipolex mystery have grown to be strangers. He hasn't really thought about them for a while. When was that? The day he sat with Zoyre in the café, smoking that reefer? Oh, that was day before yesterday, wasn't it? Rain drips, soaking into the floor, and Slothrop perceives that he is losing his mind. If there is something comforting, religious, if you want, about paranoia, there is still also anti-paranoia, where nothing is connected to anything, a condition not many of us can bear for long. Well, right now Slothrop feels himself sliding onto the anti-paranoid part of his cycle, feels the whole city around him going back, roofless, vulnerable, uncentered as he is, and only pasteboard images now of the listening enemy left between him and the wet sky. Either they have put him here for a reason, or he's just here. He isn't sure that he wouldn't actually rather have that reason. The rain lets up at midnight. He leaves Margarita to creep out in the cold city with his 5 kilos, having kept for himself the one Chichirinya plundered from. Russian troops are singing in their billets. The salt ache of accordion music cries on in back of them. Drunks materialize, merry and pissing in the center grooves of cobbled alleys. Mud occupies some streets like flesh. Shell craters brim with rainwater, gleaming in the lights of mid-watch work crews clearing debris. Shattered Biedermeier chair, mateless boot, steel eyeglass frame, dog collar. Eyes at the edges of the twisting trail watching her sign for blazing. Wine cork, splintered broom, bicycle with one wheel missing. Discarded copies of Tägliche Rundschau. Kalkedony doorknob dyed blue long ago with ferrocyanide, scattered piano keys, all white, an octave on B to be exact, or H in the German nomenclature, the notes of the rejected Locrian mode, the black and amber eye from some stuffed animal, the strewn night, spooked and shivering run behind walls whose tops are broken like fever charts. Somewhere a gas leak warps for a minute into the death and after rain smells, Ranks of blackened window sockets run high up the sides of gutted apartment buildings. Chunks of concrete are held aloft by iron reinforcing rod that curls like black spaghetti. Whole enormous heaps wiggling ominously overhead at your least passing brush by. The smooth-faced custodian of the night hovers behind neutral eyes and smile, coiled and pale over the city, humming its hoarse lullabies. Young men spent the inflation like this, alone in the street, no place to go into out of the black winters. Girls stayed up late on stoops, or sitting on benches in lamplight by the rivers, waiting for business, but the young men had to walk by, ignored, hunching over padded shoulders, money with no relation to anything it could buy, swelling, paper cancer in their billfolds. The Chicago bar is being guarded outside by two of their descendants, kids in George Raft suits, many sizes too big, too many ever to grow into. One keeps coughing in uncontrolled, dying spasms. The other licks his lips and stares at Slothrop. Gunsels. When he mentions Sawyer Boomer's name, they move together in front of the door, shaking their heads. Look, I'm supposed to deliver him a package. Don't know him. Can I leave a message? He's not here. The coffer makes a lunge. Slothrop sweeps aside, gives him a quick Veronica with his cape, sticks his foot out, and trips the kid who lies on the ground cursing, all tangled up in his long keychain, while his partner goes pawing inside of his flapping suit coat for what Slothrop surmises to be a sidearm, so him Slothrop kicks in the balls and screaming, "Fick nicht mit der Rakete, Mensch!" So they'll remember, kind of Ohio Silver here, he flees into shadows among the heaps of lumber, stone, and earth. He takes a trail. He thinks Zoira led them along the other night. Keeps losing it, wandering into windowless mazes, tangles of barbed wire holidayed by the death storms of last May. Then into a strafed and pitted lorry park he can't find his way out of for half an hour, a rolling acre of rubber, grease, steel, and spilled petrol. Pieces of vehicles pointing at sky or earth, no differently than in a peacetime American junkyard, fused into odd brown Saturday Evening Post faces, except that they are not folksy so much as downright sinister. Yes, it's really the Saturday Evening Post, all right. They are the faces of the tricorned messengers coming in from out of the long pikes, down past the elms, Berkshire legends, travelers lost at the edge of the evening, come with a message. They unwrinkle, though, if you keep looking. They smooth out into timeless masks that speak their entire meaning. All of it, right out on the surface. It takes an hour to find Zoira's cellar, but it's dark and it's empty. Slothrop goes in, lights the light, looks like either a bust or a gang war. Printing press vanished, clothes tossed all around, and some very strange clothes at that. There is, for example, a wickerware suit, a yellow wickerware suit, actually, articulating along armpit, elbow, knee, and groin lines. Oh, well. Slothrop runs a quick search of his own here, looking inside shoes, not really shoes, some of them, but foot gloves with individual toes, not, however, sewn, but cast from some unpleasant variegated resin such as bowling balls are made of. Behind the peeling scraps of wallpaper, up in the rolled-up window shade, among the hatchings of one or two phony Reichsmarks let spill by the looters, 15 minutes of this, finding nothing. And the white object on the table watching him out of its staring shadows the whole time. He feels its stare before he spots it, finally. A chess piece 2 inches high. A white knight, molded out of plastic. And wait till Slothrop finds out what kind of plastic. Boy, it's a horse's skull. The eye sockets are hollow far down into the base. Inside one of them is a tightly rolled cigarette paper with a message from Zoira. Rakete Mensch, Der Springer asks me to give you this, his symbol. Keep it. By it shall he know you. I am at Jakobistrasse 12, Dritter Hof, number 7. As B/4, me. I? Now, as B/4 was John Dillinger's old sign-off. Everybody in the zone this summer is using it. It indicates to people how you feel about certain things. Zoira has included a map showing how to get to where he is. It's clear back in the British sector. Groaning, Slothrop pushes on back out in the mud and early morning. Around the Brandenburg Gate, a slight drizzle starts up again. Chunks of the gate still lie around in the street, leaning shells spalled up in the rainy sky. Its silence is colossal. Haggard as he pads by, flanking it, the chariot gleaming like coal, driven and still. It is the 30th century, and swashbuckling rocket man has just landed here to tour the ruins. the high desert traces of an ancient European order. The Jakobistrasse and most of its quarter, slums, survived the street fighting intact, along with its interior darkness, a masonry of shadows that will persist whether the sun is up or down. Number 12 is an entire block of tenements dating from before the inflation, 5 or 6 stories, and a mansard, 5 or 6 Hinterhöfe nested one inside the other, boxes of a practical joker's gift, nothing in the center but a last hollow courtyard smelling of the same cooking and garbage and piss decades old. Ha ha. Stothorpe moseys toward the first archway. Streetlight throws his caped shadow forward into a succession of these arches, each labeled with a faded paint name. Erster Hof, Zweiter Hof, Dritter Hof, und so weiter, shaped like the entrance to the Mittelwerke, parabolic, but more like an open mouth and gullet. Joints of cartilage receding, waiting, waiting to swallow. Above the mouth, 2 squared eyes, organdy whites, irises pitch black stare him down. It laughs, as it has for years, without stopping, a blubbery and percussive laugh, like heavy china rolling or bumping under the water in the sink. A brainless giggle, just big old geometric me. Nothing to be nervous about, come on in. But the pain, the 20, 25 years of pain paralyzed back in that long throat. Old outcast, passive, addicted to survival now, waiting the years out, waiting for vulnerable saps like Slothrop here to expose itself to, laughing and crying and all in silence. Paint peels from the face, burned, diseased, long time dying, and how can Slothrop just walk down into such a schizoid throat? Why, because it is what the guardian and potent studio wants from him, natürlich. Slothrop is the character juvenile tonight. What's kept him moving the whole night, him and the others, the solitary Berliners who come out only in these evacuated hours, belonging and going no place, is their unexplained need to keep some marginal population in these wan and preterite places. Certainly for economic, though, who knows, maybe emotional reasons, too. Zoyle is on the move, too, though inside, prowling his dreams. It looks like one big room, dark, full of tobacco and kiff smoke, crumbled ridges of plaster where walls have been knocked out, straw pallets all over the floor, a couple on one sharing a late quiet cigarette, somebody snoring on another. Glossy Bösendorfer Imperial Concert grand piano over which Trudy, wearing only an army shirt, leans, a desperate muse. Bare legs long and stretching. Please come to bed, Gustav. It'll be light soon. The only answer is a peevish strumming among the lower strings. Doyle is on his side, quite still, a shrunken child, face long worked at by leaps from second-story windows, first rubdowns under gloved and womanish sergeant's fists in the precinct stations, golden light in the afternoons over the racetrack at Karlshorst, black light from the pavements of boulevard at night finely wrinkled like leather stretched over stone, white light from satin dresses, glasses stacked shining in front of bar mirrors, sans serif hues at the entrances to underground stations pointing in smooth magnetism at the sky to bring down steel angels of exaltation, of languid surrender, a face that in sleep is awesomely old, abandoned to its city's history. His eyes open. For an instant, Fothrop is only shadowed green folds. Highlighted helmet, light value still to be put together. Then comes the sweet nodding smile. Everything's okay. Ja, howdy, Rocket Man. Was ist los? Though the unregenerate old doper is not quite kindly enough to keep from opening the ditty bag right away and peering in, eyes like 2 piss holes in a snowbank to see what he has. I thought you'd be in a slam or something. Out with a little Moroccan pipe, and Zoyla sets to flattening a fat crumb of that hashish, humming the popular rumba, a little something from Morocco, with just a little bit of socco. Oh, well, Springer blew the whistle on our counterfeiting operation. Kind of a little temporary hitch, you understand. I don't, you're supposed to be ace buddies. Not nearly, and he moves in higher orbits. It is something very complicated, having to do with American Yellow Seal script being discontinued in the Mediterranean theater, with the reluctance of Allied forces here to accept Reichsmarks. Springer has a balance of payments problem, too, and he's been speculating heavily in sterling and... But, says Slothrop, but, where's my million marks, then, Emil? Zoyra sucks yellow flame flowing over the edge of the bowl. It is gone where the woodbine twineth. Exactly what Jubilee Jim Fisk told the Congressional Committee, investigating his and Jay Gould's scheme to corner gold in 1869. The words are a reminder of Berkshire. With nothing more than that to go on, it occurs to Slothrop that Zoya can't possibly be on the bad guy's side. Whoever they are, their game has been to extinguish, not remind. Well, I can sell by the ounce from what I have, Slothrop reckons. For occupation script, that's stable, isn't it? You aren't angry, you really aren't. Rocket Man is above all that shit, Emil. I have a surprise for you. I can get you the Schwarzgerät you asked about. You? Springer, I asked him for you. Quit fooling, really? Jeepers, that's so swell of you. How can I... £10,000 sterling. Rothrop loses a whole lungful of smoke. Thanks, Emil. He tells Zoya about the run-in with Chicherinya and also about how he saw that Mickey Rooney. Rocket Man, Spaceman, welcome to our virgin planet. We only want to be left in some kind of peace here, okay? If you kill us, don't eat us. If you eat, don't digest. Let us come out the other end again, like diamonds in the shit of smugglers. Look, remembering now the tip that Gailey gave him long ago in Nordhausen. Did your pal Springer mention he was hanging out in Svinemünde these days, any place like that? Only the price of your instrument, Rock. Half the money in front. He said it would cost him at least that much to track it down. So he doesn't know where it is. Shit, he could have us all on the hook, bidding us up, hoping somebody's fool enough to front him some dough. Usually he delivers. You didn't have any trouble, did you, with that pass he forged? Yeah. Oh. Oh, wow. Yes, been meaning to ask you about this little Max Schlepzig item here. Now then... But meantime, Trudy has abandoned Gustav in the piano and comes over now to sit and rub her cheeks against the nap of Slothrop's trousers, their naked legs whispering together, hair spilling, shirt half unbuttoned, and Zoya has at some point rolled over and gone groaning back into sleep. Trudy and Slothrop retire to a mattress well away from the Bösendorfer. Slothrop settles back, sighing, takes his helmet off, and lets big, sweet, and zoftic Trudy have her way with him. His joints are aching with rain and city wandering. He's half blitzed. Trudy is kissing him into an amazing comfort. It's an open house here. No favorite senses or organs. All are equally at play. For possibly the first time in his life, Slothrop does not feel obliged to have a hard-on, which is just as well because it does not seem to be happening with his penis as much as with... Oh, mercy, this is embarrassing, but... Well, his nose actually seems to be erecting. The mucus beginning to flow. Yes, a nasal hard-on here, and Trudy has certainly noticed, all right, how could she help, but as she slides her lips over the throbbing snoot and sends a yard of torrid tongue up one of his nostrils. He can feel each pink taste bud as she penetrates even farther, pulling aside the vestibule walls and nose hair now to accommodate her head, then shoulders, and, well, she's halfway in, might as well. Pulling up her knees, crawling, using the hair for hand and footholds, she is able to stand at last inside the great red hall, which is quite pleasantly lit. No walls or ceiling she can really discern, but rather a fading to seashell and springtime grades of pink in all directions. They fall asleep in a room full of snoring with low-pitched twangs out of the piano and the rain's million-legged scuttle in the courtyards outside. When Slothrop wakes up, it's at the height of the evil hour. Trudy is in some other room with Gustav rattling coffee cups. A tortoise-shell cat chases flies by the dirty window. Back beside the Spree, the white woman is waiting for Slothrop. He isn't especially disposed to leave. Trudy and Gustav come in with coffee and half a reefer, and everybody sits around, gabbing. Gustav is a composer. For months he has been carrying on a raging debate with Zoya over who is better, Beethoven or Rossini. Zoya is for Rossini. I'm not so much for Beethoven qua Beethoven, Gustav argues, but as he represents the German dialectic, the incorporation of more and more notes into the scale, culminating with dodecaphonic democracy, where all notes get an equal hearing, Beethoven was one of the architects of musical freedom. He submitted to the demands of history despite his deafness. While Rossini was retiring at the age of 36, womanizing and getting fat, Beethoven was living a life filled with tragedy and grandeur. So, is Zoira's customary answer to that one, which would you rather do? The point is, cutting off Gustav's usually indignant scream, a person feels good listening to Rossini. All you feel like listening to Beethoven is going out and invading Poland. Oh, to joy indeed. The man didn't even have a sense of humor.
I tell you, taking his skinny old fist, there is more of the sublime in the snare drum part to La Gatta Ladra than in the whole Ninth Symphony. With Rossini, the whole point is that lovers always get together, isolation is overcome, and like it or not, that is the one great centripetal movement of the world. Through the machineries of greed, pettiness, and the abuse of power, love occurs. All the shit is transmuted to gold. The walls are breached. The balconies are scaled. Listen. It was a night in early May, and the final bombardment of Berlin was in progress. Zoira had to shout his head off. The Italian girl is in Algiers. The barber's in the crockery. The magpie is stealing everything in sight. The world is rushing together. This rainy morning, in the quiet, it seems that Gustav's German dialectic has come to its end. He has just had the word, all the way from Vienna along some musician's grapevine, that Anton Webern is dead. Shot in May by the Americans, senseless, accidental if you believe in accidents, some mess cook from North Carolina, some late draftee with a .45 he hardly knew how to use, too late for World War II, but not for Webern. End of side 14. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.